I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Dr. Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast.
On this episode of the Addiction Psychologist Podcast, we have Dr. Jeff Boisano joining us. Dr. B is an associate professor in the Department of Anesthesiology at the University of Minnesota, and he'll be discussing the intersection between pain and substance use.
Dr. Jeff Boisano, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We're really, really happy to have you. We're excited about this topic. Before we get started, we like to ask all of our guests about their training history. Would you mind giving us sort of an overview of that?
Sure. Yeah. So back as a senior undergraduate, I considered very strongly applying to both neuroscience programs and entomology programs. I was at an entomology minor in college, decided on neuroscience. So life could have gone very differently if I'd chosen another way. And so I applied to and was accepted to University of Wisconsin-Madison and the University of Florida, and opted for a number of reasons that might be a little too granular for people to be interested in, to go to the University of Florida, where I was in the interdisciplinary program in biomedical sciences. So it was, you know, neuroscience was part of that, but there was also biochemistry, molecular biology, genetics, a few other concentrations. So I was in the cognitive behavioral piece of that program. There were two of us in my cohort in cognitive and behavioral neuroscience. And in that program, I worked with Sarah Jo Nixon, who many listeners might be familiar with. And when I started working with her, we were spending a lot of time in residential treatment centers doing, diagnostic interviews, looking at the the effects of chronic heavy alcohol use on neurocognitive function. So working memory function, attentional function, those sorts of things, and how a nicotine replacement might affect deficits in recovery. That work sort of transitioned actually into acute alcohol administration and non-treatment seeking populations while I was a student there. So we got an R01 funded that I had kind of an F31 riding on, where we were looking at the acute effects of moderate alcohol intake on working memory function in younger and older adults. And that included also some tasks like driving simulation and that sort of thing. Having gone into graduate school, my intent was really to focus on stress response. I was really interested in neuroendocrinology, HPA axis, cortisol, all of that good stuff. Brian Nadanoff was a hero of mine, you know, like that kind of work. I was finishing my work with Sarah Jo, and it turned out that there was a fellowship available, a slot on a fellowship available in the Pain Research and Intervention Center of Excellence on a T32. And I thought, what's a better stressor than pain, right? Like, if I want to get back to my initial interest in stress response and all of that, why not take this fellowship? So I applied and got it, and I did a 2-year postdoctoral fellowship with Mike Robinson in the Department of Clinical and Health Psychology at the University of Florida, and then I stayed in that department starting in 2015 as faculty and until just about 5 months ago when I moved to the University of Minnesota. So I'd say in total I spent 16 years, I think just under 16 years at the University of Florida in different roles, but graduate student, postdoc, faculty, all the way up. So, yeah.
Yeah. Which is fairly unusual in some ways, right? But I think really gave you access to some of the best training out there. Shout out Sarah Jo. Also, we haven't had anybody with the Sarah Jo connection in a while slash at all, really. But Sarah Jo just has a huge footprint in the field. And so, and an amazing person and scholar. And so shout out Sarah Jo for
happy to represent.
Yeah. Yeah. She's always been just so amazing to me and so helpful for things like in the Society of Addiction Psychology, former president, yeah, all those types of things, you know, proponent to help develop the Collaborative Perspectives on Addiction Conference and all these things, all stuff which have been contributed to all of our careers in meaningful ways. And so shout out Sarah Jo.
Yeah. Different ways to make impacts, right? Like through science and which she has, you know, and also through scientific citizenship. So really great group down there at Florida. And Jeff, you know, totally. I think it's really interesting. Part of your career trajectory that I think is very interesting is that you've sort of had your footprint, you know, like a lot of us kind of are in a department of psychology, and then we go to a department of psychology, and then, you know, and then we retire in a department of psychology. Not that the two of us are moving towards retirement, I think, quite yet, but you've kind of moved around a little bit, and right now you're in an anesthesiology department in a school of medicine. I'm wondering if you could just speak to that for a second about what that experience has been like to sort of be amongst other, you know, interdisciplinary departments and sort of what your role kind of looks like in an anesthesiology department.
Yeah, it is unusual, but honestly, it's been really awesome to have so many different kinds of professional homes. You know, when I was a graduate student with Sarah Jo, that was in a department of psychiatry. So that's where I kind of grew up. My postdoc was in dentistry. And actually my ID so card said Department of Orthodontics. but, you know, I mean, dental pain is a huge concern, yeah. Right? Oral facial pain is a huge concern. So that's where the T32 was. And, you know, that actually ended up being really great because I had a lot of experience kind of being around psychiatrists in a psychiatric environment, thinking about research in the context of psychiatry. But then I got to spend a couple of years in the context of dentistry, right? And talking to people who think about, you know, jaw pain, tooth pain, you know, and not just as a clinical problem, but also as kind of like a model system for understanding pain, right? So, you know, I remember at one point a meeting with my postdoctoral advisor, Mike Robinson, who's a clinical psychologist by training, but has a lot of oral facial pain background. With a dental colleague, and we were planning a study on placebo and nocebo effects using different types of dental separators in people with braces, you know, so it's like, you know, different tools, different ways of understanding that I wouldn't have encountered otherwise. And so then from there, I stayed in the Department of Clinical and Health Psychology, where Mike Robinson was and was faculty there. And so then it was kind of like, I'm a neuroscientist, right, by training. But I'm in the psychology department, always, you know, it's interesting. I always feel a little bit like you're coming at it with a slightly different frame of reference.
Totally.
Teaching more psychology than I ever took as a student, you know, which is an interesting place to be. So it wasn't that big a departure, actually, in some ways, to jump to anesthesiology after that. I've been in, you know, medical schools before and the College of Dentistry before, which has some similarity. And it is a different context, but I think that it, you know, people are coming at it, of course, from the background of anesthesia, which has very similar to problems to any other field, but, you know, ones that I feel equipped to be a good citizen around, you know, so they're interested in the basic science piece, but I've also had conversations with people about behavioral factors involved in, you know, do people use, perioperative, warming devices to help, you know, prevent hypothermia during surgeries, right? So like, that's not really related to my expertise, except that I am, you know, I do a lot of behavioral science, and we think about behavior change as part of addiction and also in pain treatment. So bringing that frame of reference has been good. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's really interesting because we, as we get our degrees, we are sort of learn to wield different tools and to sort of think different thoughts. And so to be surrounded by these people who are trained differently, I think can really bolster your research. I think your research shows that a lot of just like the different methods that you've used and the different approaches. I'm always just whenever we chat, just like surprised, like, whoa, that's like totally I would have never thought of that approach. And yet it's effective. And so we're going to jump into that. I do want to ask you one other question. Entomology.
Yeah.
You have an insect of choice,
insects,
Jeff?
Yeah.
Oh, so my favorite, I was really interested in blood-sucking insects, in particular, like true bugs. Not all bugs are bugs. Not all insects are bugs, right? But some bugs are bugs.
Wow.
And there's different, some bugs are blood-sucking, And so the physiological feat of consuming a blood meal, there we go, that's maybe 500% of your body weight. And then how do you process that, excrete that, all that sort of thing. That's what I was really interested in. So that's, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's fascinating. Like ticks and stuff?
Not ticks, yeah, but... Those are, I think they're definitely outside. We're going back a long way here.
Well, you got pretty far though. I mean, you know a lot more, I think, than the average person who didn't go into entomology. So,
I fell down the rabbit hole a little bit with it. Yeah, but, they're so cool. They're just like little robots. They're amazing little creatures. I'm a fan.
Yeah,
I still to this day, except for cockroaches, I'll generally move a bug outside if I find it in the house, but.
Yeah. Yeah. I tried to do the same thing. I'm a big fan of Edward O. Wilson. I read a few of his books, a famous late entomologist. And that's another that, you know, just talking about this sort of like getting your head into this, you know, into other fields. I think it's always a healthy thing to do to read other things. So thanks for entertaining me there, Jeff.
Of course.
Yeah.
The danger is that we'll keep talking about insects and not get to the other stuff. So.
Well, that is a good lead in, Jeff, and let's go ahead and make that jump. So, a lot, obviously, Department of Anesthesiology. If our listeners haven't sort of got the hint yet, we're going to be talking a lot about pain today. Pain, I think, is on the radar of the average person, at the average psychologist, more now than it was maybe 20 years ago. For a host of different reasons, you know, the opioid epidemic, I think that brought that to the forefront. I think with an aging population as well, we have more discussion around pain. So we think that this is a really important and timely topic, and we're very excited to have your expertise, Jeff. So I wonder if we could first start with just maybe a little bit of an overview of sort of epidemiology, like, you know, how many people are experiencing something like, and even as I'm asking this question, I'm realizing, you know, there are probably different types of pain that I'm a little bit less privy to. I usually think of chronic pain, right? But if you could give us a little bit of an overview of the epidemiology.
Yeah, so pain is, of course, more or less ubiquitous. Almost everybody has pain. There are some rare congenital disorders where people are unable to perceive pain that are related to sodium channel mutations and that kind of thing. But that's, you know, you're talking about hundreds or thousands of people globally who might be affected by that. So it's pretty much ubiquitous, pretty much universal. You know, I think when we talk about the prevalence of pain, we're usually talking about chronic pain. The prevalence of acute pain is very high. You know, I encountered it earlier when I stubbed my toe, right? I mean, like,
yeah.
Generally speaking, pain is not really a bad thing per se. Like, we think of it as like, oh, this is painful. Oh, this is, you know, this is awful.
Let's eliminate
Eliminate the pain. But pain does serve a purpose, which I know is sort of obvious, but also is worth pointing out, which is that if you can't feel it, then you don't know that your hand is on the hot stove, or you don't know that your water heater is set too high and you're scalding yourself while you take a shower, or you don't know that you broke your foot when you stubbed your toe earlier, or, you know, all of those sorts of things that are very useful for us as human beings and living organisms to know, you won't, right? So pain does serve a purpose. Where pain becomes problematic is when it's chronic. And the prevalence of chronic pain is very high relative to many other conditions. And I will pause here for a second and say that the definition of chronic pain is pretty arbitrary.
Yeah.
We tend to think of it as being pain that persists for at least 3 months after onset. But there are different definitions. Like, sometimes you might ask people, have you had pain on more than half the days over the past 6 months? Or, you know, so there's always some flex and some arbitrary judgments that you're making there. But with the standard definition, the most recent estimates that I'm aware of are around 20 to 30% of individuals in the US experience chronic pain. Hmm. So up to 1 in 3, certainly 1 in 4 is a good estimate. Not all of that is high impact chronic pain, which we would define as pain that significantly impairs your daily life. you know, that would impair your functioning. Yeah. And that's closer to 10%. But you're still talking about a pretty large group of people. And I know we're talking about the epidemiology of pain right now, but those numbers are quite a bit higher when you start looking at the population of people with substance use disorder. So it is a really common condition. Prevalence goes up with age. Prevalence goes up. Well, there's a number of different risk factors for pain, but in a number of different kinds of pain, which you alluded to earlier. And, you know, just to go over some of those, neuropathic pain is one. So that would be pain that's related to a nerve injury, which, you know, a very common example of that might be chemotherapy induced neuropathic pain. So that's a chemotherapy drug given during cancer treatment can damage the peripheral nerves. And then you get this like abnormal firing of the nerve that's not always, but often quite painful. Or trigeminal neuralgia would be another example of that, which is a, you know, a neuropathic facial pain that's very debilitating. There's also chronic heavy alcohol use can lead to a peripheral neuropathy that's associated with pain. So that is that's one type. The most common type is non-cancer musculoskeletal pain. So think things like low back pain, knee pain, neck pain, shoulder pain. Things that you might go to a physical therapist for, or, you know, a chiropractor, you know, like that kind of thing, or you might experience after you hurt yourself at the gym or lifting a heavy box or something. That's the most common type of pain. Actually, in the US, the most common type of pain is, low back pain. It's about 30% of people experience low back pain. Yeah. Mine too.
Yeah. Yeah. It starts early, you know. That's means, yeah, carrying backpacks, I guess, to our classes and throughout graduate school and stuff.
Yeah, mine's from carrying around my child. She like is getting bigger, but still wants to do this, and I'm getting older. We're both getting older, and it's making it less and less functional to occur.
Right, right. Well, Jeff, you alluded to this. That's very thorough overview of just sort of pain. Broadly, you alluded to this, that there are sort of higher rates among substance, people with substance use disorder. Do you know the prevalence of that?
Yeah. So in our data, so this is data from treatment seekers, residential treatment seekers, prevalence is over 50%.
Wow.
So it's quite a bit higher. In our control sample that we recruited for that study, it was about 30%. So it was about 20% higher. In absolute terms, in the treatment seekers. And it was across pain conditions, whether it was, you know, headache, fibromyalgia, back pain, knee pain. It was sort of across the board elevated.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Right. And so if you think about, you know, like pain as a construct or as a concept, right, you know, I've always thought about it as like, you know, it's kind of your body telling you corrective action is required. Right. That like whatever the activity that we're engaging in is causing harm to our body. Right. And that we need to alter our behavior to, you know, maybe alleviate some of those damages that are being caused. Right. And so you can imagine how a person who's experiencing pain might think, you know, maybe substance use, hey, that helps make the pain go away. Right. That doesn't really take into consideration maybe some of the ideas around corrective action is required, which for, you know, not everybody really thinks about when they think about pain, right? But I can also imagine maybe it probably goes the other way too, right? Where like substance use potentially affects pain. Is that?
Yes.
Am I off base on that?
Hmm. No, you're absolutely right. And it affects it, you know, both acutely and chronically. Hmm. And they tend to be sort of countervailing. One point that I kind of want to back up and make is about the nature of pain, actually, which is that pain is by definition, both a sensory and emotional experience, right? Yeah. So when we talk about when people are self-managing pain, you know, and that I think of it as, you know, by drinking or using substances or whatever, it could also mean taking Tylenol or ibuprofen or using a cold pack or a hot pack or whatever, right? When people are self-managing pain, you know, it's important to remember that pain by definition has that affective component to it. Hmm. And so what they're managing may be as much the affect as the sensation. Hmm. So now I want to get back to your question, which was, you know, how does substance use affect pain? And I'm going to focus more on alcohol than other things because that's where I have more expertise and we've done more research, but I'm happy to touch on other substances as well. But, you know, in the case of alcohol, what we see acutely, and we've done several studies on this, thanks to NIAAA. So thanks to NIAAA.
Shout out to NIAAA.
And we've done this in both people in the MRI environment, in people who don't have chronic pain, as well as outside the MRI in people who have chronic orofacial pain. And in both cases, we see that consuming a legally intoxicating dose of alcohol, so we're talking 0.08 grams per deciliter here, seems to significantly increase pain thresholds. It's increasing pain tolerance, and it's decreasing pain intensity that people are reporting. And it also people perceive a lot of relief. I actually, that's one of the most interesting parts to me is that perception of relief, which I'll come back to in a second. But the chronically, sort of long-term, what we see with heavy alcohol use in particular is that one, well, you have the risk of developing that painful neuropathy,
yeah,
right?
So yeah, you mentioned that, yeah.
Yeah, so you might, and the estimates of prevalence of that in treatment seekers is pretty wide, but 25 to 60% was, I think, the most recent figure I saw, so.
Well, but even 25% is like staggeringly high to me, like in a treatment. So yeah, that's very high. So it's not among people, you know, with severe patterns of use. It's not uncommon.
No, it's not uncommon.
Yeah.
It's not uncommon. And so that's one, you know, mechanism by which chronic heavy use can make pain worse is by actually inducing a new type of pain that somebody may not have had before. Right. Mm. Which is this neuropathy. It could also interact with other types, you know, maybe somebody has like a diabetic neuropathy or some other kind of condition. It could interact synergistically with that and not in a good way. But the other thing is that it's the animal literature shows, and as well as some more observational studies that repeated binge withdrawal cycles seem to increase pain sensitivity. So they result in what we call hyperalgesia. Wow. Which is greater pain response to something that's typically painful, as well as allodynia, which is perceiving something that's not typically painful as painful. So allodynia would, an example of that would be somebody with a neuropathy. If you, you know, stroke the affected part of the body with a feather, that might be perceived as very painful, even though it wouldn't normally be.
Wow.
So we do see that long-term, even though it is acutely producing some reductions and presumably some negative reinforcing processes, you know, related to pain relief, it can make pain worse in the long term.
So it sounds like those are pretty sort of siloed into acute effects and chronic effects, where mm-hmm. acute effects are typically analgesic. If someone had a neuropathy from drinking, does consuming alcohol, even at that stage, does it have analgesic effects at that point?
That's a great question. I am unaware of anyone who's actually studied that.
Okay.
That's
my wild card question for the episode. So we went ahead and got it out.
No, I like it. I mean, it's a really good question, but it actually is a good illustration of all the gaps that we have in this area, right? Like there's not too many of us in the US or worldwide actually who are, you know, doing alcohol challenge in the context of pain testing.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I think it's very much an emerging area. And so like that kind of specific question about like, well, does it affect different types of chronic pain differently?
Yeah.
We really haven't addressed at this point. I'll give you my educated guess, based on, you know, my knowledge of other treatments for neuropathic pain, like gabapentin and pregabalin and those kinds of drugs, kind of anticonvulsants, which is that it may have some modest effects on, you know, the pain experience per se, but given our experience with people's perception of relief, I bet it would produce relief. But probably not change the pain itself too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. And all of this is bound up also too, right, with just like the acute intoxicating effects of alcohol, where the pain might be present still, but the intoxication profile masks it in some meaningful way, which produces, perceived relief, right? Even though maybe some of the damages that are occurring are ongoing, and their processes by which they occur are unchanged slash made worse.
That's right. Yeah, we don't really have a good, I'll say we don't have a full understanding now of how people are making that judgment of whether or not it's working.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
The same principles really would apply to cannabis here as
Oh, yeah.
another great example.
Yeah.
Cannabis is actually interesting too because, well, it's a whole can of worms about what even is cannabis, like
Yep.
how much THC, how much
Sure.
CBD, how about the terpenes, like all this stuff,
Yeah.
right? So it's kind of like whack-a-mole. But the laboratory studies that exist about the effects of cannabis use on pain don't show much of an analgesic effect, like even less than our alcohol studies do. They're pretty small. The number needed to treat, if I remember right from the last meta-analysis I read, was around 21. The number needed to harm was around 7. So, the meta-analyses around clinical trials and these laboratory trials are not, or laboratory studies are not very compelling.
Right.
But people do perceive that it's working, right? And so, what does it, one of the things that I'm really interested in right now is what does it mean for it to work?
Yeah.
And what predicts that?
Yeah.
And our own data, which was not designed for this purpose, so I'm not going to sign an affidavit or anything that this is the truth. But the best evidence we have in our own data right now is that what predicts that rating of relief is people's ratings of intoxication and, sort of that high positive component
Yeah,
of
that makes sense.
subjective response and to a lesser extent, the low positive. So that kind of both stimulating and the positive aspects of sedating effects. But the changes in pain don't have any relationship with their relief ratings, which I find very interesting.
That is very interesting.
That is very
Yeah.
interesting.
I
Well,
mean, it follows the same kind of, to back up to the point you made earlier about like, the emotion, the affective component of pain, right? Like a lot of this follows the same predictions or expected like relationships that affect has with substance use, right? That, it in some cases has, acute benefits on your mood, but it ends up making mood stabilization and chronically worse, right? And actually produces in a person, mood disorders, for instance, due to the ways that your brain adapts to kind of having this on board on all the time. And so I guess it does make sense that, like, given that quality of pain, that maybe the affective component of it is being, pushed around here a little bit, but the physical components of pain are potentially doing things a little bit different.
I think that's true. And it's consistent with the best lab evidence we have right now, which is that the effects of pain on substance use, or really alcohol use in this case is what I mean, tend to be mediated by negative affect. So it's acting indirectly through pain-related negative
Yeah.
affect.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Well, and it strike, I mean, as you're talking about this and the separation between sensation and emotion or affect, I mean, it strikes me that mood also is sort of the combination of those two things, in sort of its own way. But anxiety or depression, you people do have that sort of sense of something going on physiologically that's happening, or maybe not very much of a sense, but it's part of the equation. So it kind of actually leads me a little bit to a section that we wanted to discuss. We maybe got away from it a little bit, but I think it's relevant here, especially as we start talking about the acute effects of alcohol. Why does it lead to an analgesic effect? Is what exactly is happening on that biological level when pain exists, and then when alcohol is consumed? And we, I'll sort of caveat that with we are not neuroscientists. So if possible, in a way that I can understand.
No, for sure. So this is a good opportunity to give a little more background on pain, actually, and a useful distinction. which is that, you know, pain exists in the brain, right? Mm-hmm. So it's useful to distinguish pain from what we call nociception. So yeah. Nociception is pain associated peripheral signals, you know, traveling into the central nervous system that then get interpreted by the brain, right?
So that's stuff like heart rate or sort of the perception of your heart rate, stuff like that.
Oh, I mean, even more directly, like, let's say I've got a knife and I cut my arm a little bit or something like that, right? Like the signal, coming from my skin that's associated with me breaking the skin and triggering all these free nerve endings and A delta fibers and C fibers and these nociceptive fibers goes into my spinal cord, right? If I'm unconscious, that's where it stops. Like there's been a nociceptive process, but I don't feel any pain, yeah. right? So it's my conscious awareness of the pain, my emotional experience of the pain that makes it pain. So when we talk about what's driving pain at a biological level, it's we have to think both peripherally and centrally, peripheral nervous system, central nervous system, and all the different ways that it can be modulated. But at its heart, really what you're doing is you're damaging tissue somewhere in the periphery. That signal is traveling through the peripheral nervous system to the spinal cord. It's going to synapse at the dorsal root of the spinal cord, go into the dorsal horn of the spinal cord, and then it ascends basically up into the brainstem and then the brain itself. And there are a number of different pathways that are involved in that. There's a sense in different brain areas that get involved once it reaches the brain. So there are brain regions involved in the kind of sensory and discriminative aspects of pain. So like, how intense is the pain? Where is the pain? That kind of thing, localizing the pain. There's also brain regions involved in sort of the emotional response to pain, the affective response to pain. So think things like amygdala, right? Like, you know, a fear response associated with pain or anxiety response associated with pain. There are structures and networks involved in that. And then there's a cognitive and evaluative component of pain, you know, so things like really asking the question, what does this pain mean to me? Right. And so that's actually one area where, cognitive and behavioral therapies for pain really target is people's cognitions about pain, the meaning of the pain, and trying to modulate that. Because we're not really very good about at treating pain per se. We're better at improving function in the context of pain, but really that's through changing the way that people think about it or the way that they approach it. I think I got a little bit off the initial question of the physiology of pain, but
that's helpful. That's helpful to know. I mean, to sort of, so you walked us through sort of from the, from the skin all the way up into the brain. And it seems like you were kind of suggesting that pain is almost this emergent feature of like a lot of systems in the body working together.
That's a much more eloquent way of putting it. Yes, that's exactly what I mean. Yeah.
It seems like there would be a lot of targets in there at different points to, to reduce pain or to manage pain. And you mentioned one, which is sort of this cognitive behavioral flair.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But there are also peripheral means of managing pain. Things like anti-inflammatories are a good example of that. Your aspirins and ibuprofens and naproxens and those sorts of things are targeting pain, you know, before it actually, makes it to the spinal cord, for instance. You can also target the spinal cord, things like spinal cord stimulators or, dorsal root ablation and, you know, varying levels of invasiveness. For sure. Medications might affect that. So there are a number of different ways. Opioids, of course, affect supraspinally and spinally. There's a lot of different places where you can affect pain. The problem is when pain becomes chronic, we're really not as good at targeting those things. And, pain... as it becomes chronic, what we say is that it becomes centralized, and there's a central sensitization process that occurs, which is long lasting, and you know, more. I'm not going to say permanently, but over long durations, alters people's response to nociceptive stimuli, as well as potentially other kinds of sensory input. There's a cool literature on that that's coming out. And that those changes occur both in the brain and also physiologically at the level of the spinal cord, where an incoming nociceptive signal might, you know, you might turn up the gain on that signal at the level of the spinal cord. And then, you know, so the brain is getting an even stronger signal coming from that.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. Right. What's becoming painfully obvious is that it's just like a really complex set of things, right? So you have just the physical sensations, right, of touch associated with pain, right? Are those kind of like initial systems that gotta like send the signals to the spinal cord, right? Then your body interprets those messages as being, this is an important signal for us to make some changes here, interpreted as pain by the brain, right? But the pain itself, that is multifaceted in on its own, which is that it has a cognitive component about it, which is our evaluation of its meaning and what we should do with it or not do with it, depending on our situational factors, right? The emotional response to it, is this a terrifying thing that has occurred, right? So forth and so on. In addition to, you know, a host of other factors that are going on, which makes this process both, you know, incredibly human and incredibly complicated. And so, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's also kind of like levels to some of that too, which is like pain intensity versus maybe a thing like pain interference. Is that a meaningful distinction?
It is, yes. And so I would even break it down a little bit further, which is that, you know, when we talk about pain severity, I think that's kind of like a catch-all term, but it combines this concept of pain intensity as well as pain unpleasantness. And then to my mind, those sort of interact to produce pain interference.
Gotcha.
So pain intensity, that's pretty easy to understand. An analogy we'll use in the lab when we're instructing people how to rate pain is that in pain intensity is like how loud the radio is. And pain unpleasantness might be whether you like the song or not.
Yeah.
And in practice, in most clinical pain situations and laboratory pain situations, they correlate 0.8, 0.9. There are some situations where they are, you know, more discriminable than that. But that kind of gestalt experience of how intense is the pain, how unpleasant is the pain, I think really leads to how much is this going to interfere with my day-to-day activities? And you know, that could take the form of something like kinesiophobia, like fear of movement. Oh, if I lift this box, which I need to do because I'm cleaning the house because somebody's coming over, then I'm going to hurt my back, right? And so that leads to a whole cascade. Or you know, sometimes people might just be more afraid of pain. They might have higher fear of pain, you know, and pain might just have more meaning for them. And so I think that all kind of comes together to produce that interference and, you know, what really gets in the way of people living the life they want to live.
That's a really interesting point, that I think I want to come back to after because I would like to hear a little bit more about the effect of alcohol on this, you know, so we kind of have a basic sense, of the biological processes, and where does, if you were to consume alcohol, where does that come in and how does that produce the analgesic effect?
So I'm going to give a broad answer here because we don't have, I think, great data on this.
Yeah.
Exactly what aspects of alcohol effects are driving changes in pain or that negative reinforcing process. But the short answer is that there are a lot of different places where alcohol can act. In terms of pain physiology, and then also sort of like the affective and cognitive processing of pain.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different potential interaction points, and probably many of them are involved. You know, one basic one is that alcohol acts on most neurotransmitter systems. in the brain, including those involved in pain. So, you know, we always talk about glutamate and GABA, but it also has indirect effects on endogenous opioid systems, cannabinoid systems, glycine. I mean, it's like, it's all over the place.
Yeah.
And so by modulating those systems, that's one direct way that it can, you know, affect the pain experience. Another, you know, to sort of zoom out a little bit, is that we know from the neuroimaging literature that acute alcohol intake has significant effects on the function of many brain areas that are involved in pain. So a good example that it would be like the anterior cingulate, for instance, which is involved in, you know, sort of attentional modulation, attentional allocation. So we know that alcohol has these really interesting effects on attentional function and attentional narrowing. That could produce, depending on the context, potentially both worsening of pain, but also relief of pain, right?
Yeah.
Maybe sense. If I drink, I'm more able to focus on watching Netflix and not worrying about my back pain. On the other hand, in some contexts, maybe I'm focusing more on my pain and less on other things that bring me satisfaction. So that's one area. We know that, you know, both acutely and chronically, alcohol is affecting regions involved in like cognitive control and inhibitory function and, you know, all of those things. So there's a lot of different means by which alcohol could produce that change. We have just finished a recruitment for a 5-year project where we were, I think I mentioned this before, administering alcohol in the context of MRI and looking at effects on pain. I think this question of where in the brain, obviously, you know, spinal cord is probably involved too, maybe yeah. periphery is involved, but at least in the brain, we will be able to shed some light on what's going wow. on in terms of how alcohol is affecting these pain-related networks.
Wow. So that is forthcoming, it sounds like.
Forthcoming. And so, watch this space, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Wow. That, I mean, you really, yeah, that is leaving us in suspense for sure. I'm really curious and very excited to hear about those results. But it does sound like it's fairly global in nature. And one of the reasons I think this is so interesting to me is because a lot of, you know, on the level of behavior, a lot of the things that I'm interested in is understanding how engaging in alternative activities and engaging with your environment and meaningful, you know, behaviors and with people that you care about can serve as protective factors, you know, against alcohol consumption and other drug use or harmful patterns of drug use. So it sort of sounds like there's this cycle that can form where not only does it make you feel better, right? Does alcohol maybe numb the pain a little bit? But it also, as someone goes throughout their day, they may consider these different options and think, well, if I do that, it might lead to more pain, or, you know, maybe I better just do this instead and stay at home. And so, yeah, I don't know. That's just kind of where it took my mind.
I think you're right. And I think that's one of the interesting intersections between chronic pain or actually, you know what? It doesn't have to be chronic pain. Between pain, it could be acute, could be subacute. And alcohol is that your activities might be limited by your pain, right? Mm-hmm. So you might be limited in your alternative reinforcers, right? Like, maybe I love going skiing but I can't go ski because I really, you know, my knee is super messed up right now. And so what do? I stay at the chalet and maybe I have a bottle of wine, right? So that is an area where your pain is directly, you know, limiting your options for reinforcers, for activities. And so alcohol may step in there. Interestingly, there's also neuroimaging data that overlaps nicely with the alcohol data, showing that the chronification of pain or, you know, development of chronic pain changes a lot of reward-related circuits that are also changed in terms of long-term heavy alcohol use. And so, like, yeah. There's a motivational component to it that might overlap. And so that preference for, like, an immediate, sure reinforcer that, you know, maybe there's a long-term consequence that's sort of vague, but, you know, I'm not going to mess up my back right now. I'm not going to have a flare, whatever, maybe I'll feel better for a little while, becomes more attractive.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense, actually. And also there's some literature, if you think about it from an emotional perspective, that some good EMA data that suggests that people will prioritize mood repair over other long-term goals, and pain is even more like immediate a lot of times, right? So you get an acute reinforcer, but also you get this like process that makes you at risk for long-term things chronically.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so they appear to kind of parallel, perhaps synergistically with the development of something like alcohol use disorder.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and there's that added element, I think, Jeff, you just kind of mentioned, which is that like sometimes actually going and skiing with a hurt knee could actually lead to more damage. You know, it could make things legitimately worse. Right. So there's that sort of added element of, sometimes, you know, this isn't necessarily always the case, but with mood, a lot of times we talk about, well, oh, behavioral activation. Like if you just go and do it anyway, then you might see some improvements, or at least over time. Mm-hmm. There is that distinction here a little bit where that for some, or maybe most people, that would not necessarily, now not any behavioral activation, obviously, but doing certain activities might actually exacerbate pain.
It could. And, you know, one of the important distinctions here between acute and chronic pain is that in the case of chronic pain, you know, the tissue damage is healed, right? Like you've had an injury, you still have pain, but the tissue's healed. So you might very well, there might be a physical therapist out there listening or something saying like, yeah, get them on the slope, right? Like they need to strengthen that knee. They need to work through the pain. They need to, you know, obviously you don't want to re-injure, but there may be a context where you do want to acknowledge like, yes, there is going to be pain, but it's part of, the pain is no longer serving the evolutionary purpose, which is to alert me that I need to stop doing what I'm doing.
Yeah. And this is the parallel, right? We're like, then it becomes much more like a behavior activation, committed action context, right? Mm-hmm. Where like the idea of my chronic pain is the limiting factor, not the actual tissue damage potential of the activity. But in an acute sense, that is still present.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm a runner, and so there have been times where I've had injuries, or at least I think I have injuries, right? And that, it's like there is something very like basic human instinct about having, it feels like you're falling apart, or like they're, you know, so absolute. That makes a lot of sense, and it sounds like in some cases, in a lot of cases, it could be the right move to continue, obviously, with, you know, maybe talking with professionals and having.
Yeah, I'm not telling anyone to go out there and get on the slopes necessarily. Yes, right. But
right.
But yeah, I do think that to take us on a little bit of a tangent with some other work we do that's not strictly substance related, which is around trying to build people's capacity for pain modulation. I think one of the things we very naturally do as humans is if we experience something unpleasant, we try to minimize our experience of it, right? We want to experience as little of it and as infrequently as possible. And so what that means is that for somebody who might be living with chronic pain, they might try to really minimize their experience of pain. And that could be through medications. It could be through activity avoidance, a lot of different strategies. But what that could mean is that you don't get much practice in a kind of literal sense, experiencing pain and modulating pain.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that the lab is working on right now is actually behavioral interventions, which really means exercise, vigorous eccentric exercise that produces pain repeatedly and allows it to resolve to help build that capacity back up.
Wow.
So the jury is still out on that. It seems promising in controls without pain. We're currently running a project in people with fibromyalgia to see if that also holds true in people with fibromyalgia. But
well, another thing that we'll have to circle back to you about, Jeff, it sounds related to that, I've got one more wild card, actually. You mentioned briefly that with repeated alcohol use, there can be this sort of increased sensitivity to pain that occurs. Mm-hmm. And you sort of offhanded mentioned that there is an emerging literature about how it might also increase sensitivity to other perception, to other, you know, and I'm wondering if like that's like would that mean to the physiological experience of alcohol itself?
So that's an interesting question. To give you a little more detail on what I was talking about, was some cool work that came out of actually a colleague at the University of Florida not too long ago, looking at sensitivity to, I'm going to say, I think it was loudness of sound in people with fibromyalgia.
Interesting.
A colleague named Roland Stodd, who does a lot of cool work in this area. But what he found is that people with fibromyalgia are, yes, they're more sensitive to painful stimuli. They report more pain at lower, you know, at the same temperatures as people without fibromyalgia. You know, the whole sort of constellation we expect, but they also report that sounds are louder, lights are brighter, those sorts of things. So it seems like part of this is really a new area, so I don't want to overstate it, but it's possible that part of what we see in these, you know, chronic pain conditions in particular, like these centralized and widespread chronic musculoskeletal pain conditions like fibromyalgia, or you could include chronic fatigue syndrome in that as well, might be driven by almost like a higher level of sensitization, and maybe some sort of change in how sensory input is integrated or interpreted, not just pain. And so if that's the case, maybe that helps us develop treatments that are more general, right? Or maybe we've been targeting these specific pain mechanisms, which are important, but we could also look at a higher level about those.
Yeah, that makes sense. As opposed to maybe, Sam, you were thinking a little bit about maybe like the subjective effects of alcohol.
Yeah, like
get moderated there, which would place people at risk.
Like if there's a global change in sensitivity, like is that, it sounds like everything that that you just mentioned was, I mean, I guess I would consider them to be like negative in valence, like louder sounds. And but yeah, I was wondering if there was change in sensitivity just more generally, like with positively valenced sensory experiences as well. And if not, why, you know, why that might be the case.
It's a good question. I mean, there is a lot of evidence, I think, that from the EMA literature, if I remember right, that drinking episodes do, at least in some contexts, increase positive affect and all of that. And in terms of and actually to a greater extent than they reduce negative affect, but in terms of what's going on sort of neurophysiologically, that's driving that. I mean, you could, I'm really speculating here. We're data free zone, right? But
sure.
I think that, and I'm waving for people on the podcast, I'm waving my hands in a way that suggests I have no idea if this is really true. but it could be related to the same attentional processes that I was talking about before, where, you know, it makes it a little bit easier maybe to ignore something that is not pleasant to you or irrelevant to you, at least temporarily. Or maybe you're just adding kind of a positive affective overlay, even though you're not changing your negative mood very much. I'm not sure. But.
Yeah. Well, thanks for entertaining me there, Jeff. I mean, I think generally we'll move to our take home messages here in a minute, just sort of brief 30-second overviews of, you know, specifically for key stakeholders. But I wonder if you could touch on just briefly, like, you know, you're doing a lot of different work in this area, and a lot of emerging and exciting work. And you have just a better perception of like what do we need to do better at, what is on the horizon for this field, what we still need to know. I wonder if you could give us your take on that.
Oh yeah, there's so much. there's so much, and I hope NIAAA is listening about that
so
part too. Yeah,
for a host of reasons, including this.
Yeah, there's a lot that we don't know. There's a lot of populations that we haven't studied. So I'll just give you an example. Like, to my knowledge, a study, an R21 study that we just wrapped up, was the first one that ever looked at the analgesic effects of alcohol in people with a chronic pain condition. Before that, everything had been in just period. Like, I'm pretty sure it had not been done before.
I was expecting
I'm sorry to disappoint, but as far as I know, it's not been done before we did that study.
Wow.
So that was just recently. We've had two papers come out of that recently, in people with chronic TMD pain, temporomandibular joint muscle disorder pain. So there's a lot of questions we left on the table there, right? Like, it was a start, but we still don't know, you know, why is it that 25% of people with chronic pain report heavy alcohol use? That's a lot, right? Is it, you know, that alcohol is affecting their pain differently than people without chronic pain? Is it that, you know, maybe they're experiencing pain more frequently, and so that's why they are self-managing? Is it that maybe pain is just a more potent antecedent for alcohol use in people who have chronic pain, maybe because the emotional valence of the pain changes? Maybe there's a kind of a helplessness component to it. Maybe there's, you know, more impact on daily life. Maybe there's a feeling like, oh, it's never going to get better, right? So these kind of catastrophic thoughts. We just don't know,
yeah.
Right? So what we showed in that work was that alcohol seems to affect facial pain to about the same degree, whether or not you have chronic TMD pain. People with chronic TMD pain report more pain, but alcohol seems to have the same effect. People report similar amounts of relief from our experimental pain stimulus, which was pressure on the insertion of the masseter, which is right at the base of the jaw here. Regardless of whether they had chronic pain or not. So a lot of questions there. There's the questions about kind of the neural basis of all of it. There's other populations that really haven't been studied even beyond sort of a cursory phenomenological way. So like older adults, very little research, certainly little laboratory experimental research on relationships between pain and alcohol in older people. Despite the fact that, you know, one of the things we really worry about with pain self-management with alcohol is medication interactions.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's around 40% of older people over 65 use 5 or more medications.
Yeah.
You know, prescription medications.
We,
and so that's a lot of opportunity
today.
Yeah.
That's wow.
Yeah. That's a lot of opportunity for harmful interactions and polypharmacy. And so, you know, pain in older adults would be one, pain in underserved and minoritized population, and how that relates to substance use and the consequences of substance use in those groups. Very little has been done, you know, broadly construed. So there's a lot. I think another area that I would highlight, I could talk about this for another full hour, but would just be about pain and recovery. And, you know, I know that one of the we're getting to the stakeholders, and I've listened to enough episodes to know that this is a question, but, you know, there's been very little done other than kind of longitudinal observational studies in terms of pain changes and recovery, how it relates to outcomes, that kind of thing. What's the impact of treating pain in an intentional way in, you know, in a recovery context?
Yeah.
On outcomes. So a lot of different areas, a lot of things to work on, but those are some. And then the other pet area for me, again, is like, how do people know it's working? Right.
Yeah.
I think if we can get a better idea of why people are perceiving relief, when they drink or when they use cannabis or when they smoke, right. We didn't talk about smoking, but there's a huge pain in smoking literature out there too. Then, you know, maybe that gives us a better idea of what we can target, right? Like, do we target some expectancies around what's going to occur, or do we, you know, is there some other kind of affective change that's taking place that's driving this? right? Versus a change in their pain per se. So, yeah.
Yeah, makes sense. Makes sense. A lot of work to be done here, which is important. Hopefully NIAAA is listening.
Yeah,
I hope so.
Applications come through.
I feel like we almost got into something, you know, got in over our heads with this, in the sense that this could be like you just mentioned, the sort of pain and recovery, you know, the acute effects, the chronic effects in different populations. I mean, there we could have talked about this for probably 5 or 6 hours. There's a lot to discuss and a lot that I learned myself, Jeff.
Indeed.
I really appreciate the time that you spent to come speak with us today. It's been insightful for me, hopefully for other listeners as well.
It's really fun, and I think it's an important topic that we're really just starting to get a basic handle on. The number of reviews I've gotten back that say, isn't this a solved problem? Don't we know about, you know, everything we need to know about pain and alcohol? And I'm just, no, you know, maybe that's on me. Maybe I'm not making a strong enough case, but there's a lot to be done.
You know, I heard at one point, this would be years ago, but that, like, I think out of the 130 or however many medical schools there are in the country, like 5 had specific coursework on pain. Mm-hmm. And so really, we're just not teaching about it, I think, in general. And and in a lot of medical contexts, I think it's getting better, but we're really not asking about it sufficiently as well.
Yeah.
So I think that
and pain is a great is pain is why people go to the physician. That's why they go see a doctor,
right?
Or a dentist, right? Is because they hurt.
Yeah. So, yeah. And we want to solve the problem, but and I guess the individual does too, but more so they want relief. So mm-hmm. I think that you're probably just in the right place at the right time, and sort of hopefully going to be one of several or many shepherding in sort of some new insightful research. So thank you for the contribution you're making, Jeff. And
Agreed.
If it's all right with you, we'll go ahead and shift to the take homes.
Yes, please.
Great. All right. Well, you gave us a little sample, but I'll go ahead and ask it anyway. What do you think the take-home message is for people who are in recovery?
Yeah. So there's, I've mentioned a little bit about this. There's more and more evidence that pain and recovery might be linked, and that pain and substance use are linked, even for substances that may not be super intuitive. Nicotine might be one of those. So what I would say is that if you're in the process of recovery from, you know, alcohol, nicotine, opioids, whatever the substance may be, addressing pain may improve outcomes. Like, there's not been a ton of research on this yet, but it's something that if, you know, I would encourage people that are experiencing pain who are in recovery to bring that to their provider's attention. There is a problem in pain, which we didn't really touch on, but it's a pervasive problem, which is that sometimes people in pain aren't believed and they have pain, or it's, you know, oh, it's all in your head, right? Like, I hope I've convinced people is that yes, pain is in your head, right? Because your brain is in your head. And your brain is what's interpreting that signal. And so pain is an emergent process, like you said, Sam, about that is interpreting that. So it's a real thing. It could have a real impact on your outcomes, on your trajectory, on your quality of life. And so if you're in treatment, and if you're in recovery, and you feel like your pain isn't being addressed, or maybe you've never thought, like, I'll deal with my pain, that's not my immediate problem, right? Like, maybe my problem right now is I need to deal with this substance. Thinking about pain as part of that constellation may be helpful.
Yeah, sort of an intersection of mistrust in some ways with chronic pain and substance use in early recovery.
Great point.
Tough
great
space.
Point. Yes. Yeah. So, yeah. That also has its own whole thing about providers' belief around issues,
absolutely.
Right? And when those two powers combine, I'm sure it's super can produce problematic outcomes for a host of people. All right.
Yes, absolutely.
And so what would you say to practitioners who are listening?
Kind of the mirror image of what I just said to people in recovery, which is that, you know, there is still work to be done. pain and substance use are linked, though. That's very clear. So if you're working with people with chronic pain, probably people listening to this podcast are working with people with addiction concerns. But if you're working with people with chronic pain and you're not assessing substance use, then you really should be, you should be thinking about that. Consider adding some screening measures. Consider, you know, integrating at least some assessment and referral for those folks. But by the same token, if you're working with people who are in recovery, then, you know, really think about their pain, ask about their pain, use validated measures to, you know, track pain maybe over the course of recovery, over the course of treatment. Consider it as part of like the general constellation, like you might with sleep, right? Or diet or exercise. You know, pain can be, is an important part of that. So I would say definitely do that. And the other thing is that we have some evidence, you know, from our lab, for instance, work I did with Sarah Jo and with Ben Lewis, who's at the University of Florida, looking at, and my student, Erin Ferguson, she was the first author on it, but looking at changes in pain over the course of recovery, early recovery in residential treatment seekers, we found that pain does decrease over the course of residential treatment. And people's decreases in pain were predictive of decreases in craving, increases in quality of life, increases in abstinence self-efficacy. So unfortunately, that data set was sort of limited because we didn't have follow-up data post-discharge. But at least for those, you know, the best proxy measures that we had, it seemed like, you know, addressing people's pain could really help with those outcomes. And Katie Witkowitz has done some work there too, showing that pain and treatment is predictive of return to use. And I think that was in UCAT and Project Combine.
It's really helpful. So what about take home for policymakers?
I think this is a tough one. So when I was preparing, you know, for this interview, I spent the longest time kind of racking my brain about this because I have to overcome my sort of inherent cynicism. But I think for policymakers, what I would say is that it really is about overcoming access issues to the most effective treatments. For pain, that tends to be interdisciplinary treatments. So, you know, that could be medication management, physical therapy, psychotherapy, dentistry, right? People, like a number of allied providers working together to help treat a patient and like in their whole sense, right? Those programs work pretty well, but access is limited. There's not that many of them. Insurance doesn't always want to cover it because it's expensive. Sometimes they're residential, right? So I think increasing access to those programs is really important. I think that, you know, for people who might be involved in administering treatment programs, integrating pain management and pain assessment would be important. I know there's a lot of issues around that, right? Especially around medication management and that kind of thing. But to have those assessments, to have providers on hand who maybe could provide cognitive behavioral therapy for pain or ACT for pain, acceptance and commitment therapy, might go a long way to help improve outcomes. So providing those resources, being open to providing that. And if insurers are listening, then, you know, maybe think a little bit longer term.
What about underserved populations? I know you mentioned some of this, but what are the take home messages for them?
Well, so this is a tough one in some ways, because in a way the message is that all those access issues, all of those, that comment I made about people sometimes not being believed about their pain, not having their pain taken seriously, having access to, you know, alternative reinforcing activities, like you were mentioning, Sam, those are compounded, right? Like for people who are in marginalized groups, who are, you know, maybe at the intersection of several marginalized groups, even more so. So I guess I have two messages. One is, again, for practitioners and policymakers, and then one is for the underserved folks, which is for those folks, I would say, you know, your experience of pain and substance use and or substance use is real and important. If people don't believe you, try to find someone who does believe you, who doesn't minimize your needs, doesn't minimize your care. and self-advocate the best way that you can, but recognizing that the system is not always friendly, not always accessible. And I think that's where, for practitioners, we and policymakers, we need to really be thinking about, you know, what are the biases inherent in the system? You know, how do we address those? At what stage do we address them? So, like, to give an example, we've done some work looking at biases in medical decision-making, both around pain and around referral for alcohol use treatment. You know, these are vignette studies with sometimes practicing physicians and dentists, and sometimes in trainees, medical students, dental students. But what we find is that there are pretty consistent biases where people, for instance, a study we're working on writing up right now, one of my students, Marco Funes, did his master's thesis on this, is that medical and dental students, when they're presented with vignettes about Hispanic versus non-Hispanic or Latino individuals who drink, are more likely to, or I should say less likely to, refer those folks for treatment. They're less likely to think that their alcohol use is a problem. There's all these kinds of things that, even at the early stage of training, you know, are detectable, but also potentially addressable, right? So I think we need to do better in terms of educators and practitioners in terms of recognizing biases and treating biases. So it's a long answer to a short question, but
an important question, and deserving of the length of the answer. And yeah, it seems like there's a lot of work that needs to be done in that area. And I appreciate it. Sounds like you and the people that you're training trying to address that. And that actually brings us to our last question, which, you know, I know some of the people that you've mentored, and you've provided, you know, your mentoring services to me at different times throughout my career, which I appreciate, Jeff. But, you know, what types of things would you, what types of advice would you give to trainees out there, to have a career as successful as your own?
Oh, that's nice of you. I guess I have lots of advice, but I want to keep it focused, because, again, that could go a long time. But I think the most useful piece of advice I read was, gosh, it was like an editorial in Cell from like 2005 or something. It goes, it's like not even my area. It goes back a long way, but it clearly stuck with me, which was, don't be afraid of feeling stupid. Hmm. And I think it ties into the imposter syndrome that we all feel at all stages. I've certainly felt it at every career stage so far. I presume it won't change moving forward, but you know, we're always afraid we're going to look stupid or feel stupid or that kind of thing. And so we might avoid tackling a hard problem, or we might avoid asking a question, or, you know, writing a grant or trying an analysis, right? Because we don't want it to be, we don't want to feel like we did something wrong or that we did something stupid. Yeah. And I think it's been very helpful for me to just keep in the back of my head that, especially when you're doing, you know, like PhD training, or you're doing and you're working in a new field or whatever stage of your career you're at, the reason you're doing that is because nobody knows. Yeah. And so,
great point.
You know, it's,
you might fail.
You might fail, right? Like,
yeah.
It might not work,
and that's okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're going to learn something.
Yeah.
And so I think I would just encourage people towards what the author of this, I wish I could remember his name, called productive stupidity.
Mm.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the fun of it, sort of beating your head against a problem until you have that revelation of like, oh, you know, that's how we can do it, or that's what that means. And it can be uncomfortable, but I think it's worth pursuing.
I really like that, Jeff. That's like pretty unique. I think, you know, we sometimes hear, you know, sort of the same advice or similar sort of sounding advice. That's pretty unique, and I really like it. And I guess related to that, find the people that you can be productively stupid around. And feel safe doing it with. Yeah. So, thank you.
Yeah. Well, that's another piece. Be a good collaborator.
Yeah. Be a good collaborator.
Follow through.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you so much, Jeff. This has been really delightful. I've learned a lot, and I just really appreciate your time.
Agreed.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.